Hello, everyone. This is Steve Smith. This is WCG Patient Radio. WCG is a company focused on the ethical, safe, and efficient conduct of clinical trials. We are speaking today with Dolly Niles, Executive Director of Quest Research Institute in Farmington Hills, Michigan, in the Greater Detroit metropolitan area. Quest Research Institute is one of a few multi-specialty dedicated research sites in the Metro Detroit area, and it's founded on the desire to bring the local community access to new treatments through participation in clinical trials that follow strict FDA guidelines. Quest Research Institute is what we often refer to as a small independent site. Hello, Dolly.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Dolly, large hospitals in big cities are often the places patient volunteers go to participate in clinical trials. Tell us about the role of a small independent research site in the context of clinical trials.
Yes, well, I would say that the role of our smaller independent sites has become to be very important players in implementing medical research today. Certainly, people hear more about large institutions and academic centers being part of research, but small sites are gaining a great reputation of being able to contract quickly, implement their regulatory submissions rapidly, and getting trials going very quickly. And I think not only is that important for the local community, but they're also able to easily adapt. And I think that that's what we're finding has helped them compete, even with large institutions today. They're able to modify staff to meet what I would call technical needs, technology needs. They're able to implement protocol changes quickly. They're able to add technology additions, and that becomes more important, I think, today as we get more patient-centric. They're smaller and nimble, so that helps also in just, you know, starting new trials and following the pipeline. And I think I think the final thing that we've seen is that they really have had to recognize the value of developing a relationship with the community. And I don't know that hospitals and institutions and academic centers are really able to do that as closely to the community level.
Your independent research site, Quest Research Institute, has successfully completed over 350 phase 1 to 4 clinical trials. Is that right?
That's right. We've been doing research since 1996.
So how did you yourself become involved in leading Quest Research Institute?
Well, about 15 years ago, I was asked to become part of the institution. My background is actually in technology and, you know, business. I was not in clinical at all. And I think it was, you know, probably a synergistic design, because it was starting, I think people were starting to recognize that small medical research sites had to learn how to adapt in the business world. They had to adapt a business model, knowing what good contracts were, how to be a profitable business, small business, while also, you know, being educated in the medical field. But, you know, the other aspects like business development and marketing and, you know, community outreach, those were newer elements in the medical research field 15 years ago.
A lot of patients may not realize that clinical trials aren't just maybe constantly running in a place, but a pharmaceutical drug developer has to choose the sites for their clinical trials based on the feasibility of patient enrollment and success, whether or not they think the site will be successful. And they may blend large academic medical centers with smaller sites. Do you think there is an increased value to them of using smaller sites now in this time of COVID?
Well, absolutely. I think that we've seen that. Okay, so I think there's two kind of questions there. Certainly, they have to blend both. I think that sponsors are getting, they're understanding the value of the smaller sites that are closely tied to communities and have strong relationship with, you know, the local advocacy groups and support groups and those sorts of niche operations that are within their patient population that they're seeking. They also, I think, see that independent sites are faster. So if you have a small phase one or two trial, you don't have 3 or 4 months to get a study up and running, which they may encounter that at larger institutions. Certainly not all, but I do think on average, independent sites tend to just be much quicker to start up, and they're able to get their trial going. You know, I think when it comes to COVID, now what we've experienced is we've seen, you know, in the Metro Detroit area, hospitals have had to reallocate research staff to the floor to manage COVID patients. So their priority is not the research study. They have a lot of bigger priorities in helping the community. And I think that sponsors have seen that now, that, you know, it's important to have access to the community through these larger institutions because they just have big populations. However, it's not the priority to get their very, very important research study completed. The second thing I think that we've seen is the hospitals have welcomed independent sites in helping them. I mean, we've helped with reallocating drug to patients because they don't want research patients coming to the hospital. You know, they're trying to keep that separate from COVID patients and workload. You know, they need only really emergency stuff coming to the emergency room. So I think we've seen two things happen there with COVID.
So this is in the interest of the patients because, of, first and foremost, of course, is patient safety. The hospitals want to keep the patients who may have chronic diseases, and that's why they're in a clinical trial, away from the COVID environment, as well as, like you pointed out, they don't have the staff available right now to do the clinical trials, but the patients still need those medications, and they also need to stay away from a COVID environment if they're coming in for something else.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, patients that are on research medication, you know, that's a more important visit than even a PCP visit, because we don't know things about this medication yet, right? We're supposed to be providing a very strong level of oversight for people on investigational medication. And, you know, the FDA regulations, even around COVID, the guidance that's recently come out about that, you know, we are still responsible to be compliant to the protocol. In the allowances that are given, which can only be provided by the sponsor, we are, you know, at the site level, we still are responsible to be compliant.
So for a long time, patients have known that, you know, especially those with complex diseases, that the day they go to the hospital for their routine treatments or their clinical trial visits, whatever they're going for, they're probably going to spend a lot of time in the waiting room. If it's a large academic medical center especially, you have to wait between the different visits. You're inside the hospital on that day. You might see a doctor, and then you go get scanned, and then you go get a test and blood test. So I think patients welcome it when clinical trials can get closer to their homes and also be faster to get in and out. Is this something which, trend-wise, you think might stick after the COVID era has passed?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I think that this perception reigned before COVID, that people are, you know, a patient is motivated to try to go to a large academic center if their perception is that the research being done there can offer them more. You know, it's more novel, it's more groundbreaking, et cetera. So what we know at smaller sites is that's not necessarily the case. And I think that patients also have the perception that, going to a large center, it's just more cumbersome. And yes, I become kind of part of a machine, right? It's not that personal interaction that small sites, I think, strive to accomplish with their patients. So I do feel like COVID has highlighted some of that. And, you know, trying to be more patient-centric, though, has been a goal for a couple of years now, trying to bring research closer to the patient. And we certainly have experienced quite a bit of this in what we've seen more recently in protocol designs.
We're also hearing about virtual trials and the use of technology. You have a technology background. You were saying this use of technology, which is now coming into its own, we might say, that allows patients to actually stay at home to be monitored, assessed, medications administration may even be done at home where it used to be the patient would have to come to the clinic. A lot of this is accelerating, even though it's been around a while, accelerating because of COVID and the desire to continue medical care while keeping patients distant from the chance of infection. Is this something that you're also involved in?
Yes, definitely, and we've seen it. Over the past several years, you know, we've been using e-diaries for 20 years, long before there were iPhones, but now we are seeing, you know, actigraphy watches that measure movement and falls. We are seeing more patient-reported outcomes on iPhone-type applications. So because we're seeing more and more patients are very comfortable with using that. You know, even 5 years ago, I would say half of my patient population was not really used to using a smartphone. So I think that technology is happening already. And what we're finding is patients like it, and it requires a different skill set at the study coordinator level. So our job at the site is to figure out how to best implement that so that the data is still what the sponsor needs. You know, it's different issues. It's uploading and technology. And, you know, I was talking to a physician yesterday about telehealth visits, so that's a new thing for them, having to do those at the scale that they're doing them right now here in Detroit. And he said, you know, a visit that really would take 2 minutes, the problem is it's like 15 minutes because there's technology issue and having the patient understand how to, okay, turn the camera to you, those sorts of things. So, you know, that's education.
Yeah, many of us are aware of that from helping our elderly parents use the technology to do, whether it's Zoom calls or cell phones.
Right.
So Dolly, we touched earlier on the fact that COVID is impacting low-income minority populations especially hard. It's been not only national headlines, but it's also been global headlines about how this is happening in the United States. And you're in the Detroit metro area. Talk to us about that problem in your area, and how can those running clinical research do something? How does that work?
Well, I will tell you that it really does. I think COVID has really underscored and highlighted that something we already know, and that is that the minority population is significantly underrepresented in medical research. We don't know enough about minority populations and their comorbidities that they have that are obviously affecting other things like COVID. Local community sites really need to be able to spend time with figuring out how to crack that nut. How do we encourage and grow the minority population when it comes to participating in research? And I do think it comes to, you know, it is educating and providing support, knowing what that support is and providing support, but then getting out to the community to then build that trust, because they're not hearing it from their physicians, whom they trust. And so I do think it is a lack of knowledge that this is going on and that they're needed to better represent their population and to improve care for the minority groups.
Yes, we've had other senior clinical trials specialists who run trials all the time tell us that by specifically reaching out and inviting and educating and including Minority populations will participate in clinical research, and the numbers can go up in terms of how many get enrolled in trials or seek medical care for underlying conditions that may not have sought it before. So, and they talk about reaching into the communities through disease-specific community groups or going to where communities meet.
Right. You know, we have to do it, though, in a way that is not selling. And I think that's the kind of the problem with the support that sites feel they receive from funding. You know, they get very tactical funding, you know, recruiting for this study for this population, where this sort of problem is a larger issue that needs to be, you know, bringing it to the faith-based organizations to just educate about research and grow, you know, establishing this trust relationship so that when you're ready to recruit for a study for diabetes, they have that relationship, they have that education, and they are more willing then to learn more about that specific trial. And I think that, you know, independent sites need to figure out how to make time for that, how to establish the relationship with these larger advocacy groups or faith-based organizations or where these minority communities are congregating so that we can have more of a larger relationship with them and not just based on, hey, I really want you to be in my study.
Yes, that really comes across well when I speak to these community advocates, some of whom have spoken on this very same podcast series. A gentleman named Thomas Farrington out in Boston runs a prostate health education network educating African-American families about the severe impact of prostate cancer on their communities. It's very disproportionate, and they fight that health disparity by education, and they do it by going into the churches. They've put together a theater piece that travels around. There's a lot of things they've done to reach the community and probably lower the incidence of death from prostate cancer just by having people know about it and seek treatment. And then when it comes time to participate in clinical research, you have a better educated community.
Right, right. Absolutely.
Well, thank you very much, Dolly Niles. I'm afraid we're out of time today. We appreciate your taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks for having me.
This is WCG Patient Radio. I'm Steve Smith. Special thanks to our executive producer, Lauren Osmore, and our technical director, David Fogel. Thank you for listening, everybody. Goodbye.